And I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Rocky Durham. He's executive chef and co-founder of the Santa Fe Culinary Academy, and he's here to talk to us about Thanksgiving dinner. Welcome.
How's it going, Mary Charlotte?
Great to have you here. It's
going really well.
Yeah, and tomorrow is the big day, and
yeah.
Everybody's got their turkeys already if they are turkey eaters.
Have you, you're ahead of the curve. You've shopped and bought turkeys. And
you know, my significant other does not like turkey and gets a headache when he eats turkey.
Interesting, because
yes.
I was about to say that not liking turkey doesn't preclude you from actually having to participate in the turkey exercise, because I think a lot of us are used to turkey that we don't like, but we do it anyhow on Thanksgiving.
What do you mean, used to turkey that we don't like?
It seems that people do turkey poorly, and especially with the quality of bird that most people purchase and cook, it's like wet cardboard, and they do little to improve that.
Let's talk about the quality of birds. Starting
right.
with really good meat
That's
is
right.
a great way to start.
Well, with anything, you need good raw materials. And especially when it comes to meats, I'm really passionate about looking after animals. I love animals. And I eat animals. So I think it's my responsibility as an omnivore to make sure that we take care of our critters when they're still critters, before they become meat. So ethically raised animals and free range and what have you. Those are the things we're looking for when it comes to turkeys.
And ethically raised animals taste better?
Well, I think they actually taste more. You know, a lot of these industrially raised turkeys or poultry for that matter, are kind of flavorless. You know, we're used to chicken and turkey being just kind of a foil for other flavors. When you actually taste a heritage animal, and it turns out there's flavor that's there, it's really kind of wonderful. Some people, it disagrees with them, though, because they don't want to taste the meat. They just want it to be a vehicle for getting that gravy in the face hole.
And those are the people who also eat macaroni and cheese out of a cardboard box.
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct.
And, you know, we love everybody. But I think there's this wonderful movement. I mean, if you look at the 20th century to today, you see, like, people eating food off of their farms, then moving toward the industrialization of agriculture, and then the tremendous problems that come with that. And
right.
now we seem to be going in a really positive backward-forward direction toward farm-raised animals as opposed to industrially raised animals.
That's right.
And other kinds of food.
Sometimes my sister and I say, or we oftentimes quote each other and say, sometimes the way forward is backwards.
Very much so.
And when it comes to all things agrarian, I really believe strongly in that.
So everybody who is listening right now already has their turkey.
Right.
If they don't, they're about to go... Like,
they're like, wait, that's tomorrow?
And they're about to go battle the crowds.
That's right.
But, you know, we do this show every year, and we will be doing it probably for many years to come. And so, if not this year, then next year, go get yourself a good turkey.
That's
right.
Yeah, and they're available. You just have to, you might have to make an additional stop to your grocery purchasing, you know, exercise for Thanksgiving. But it's really worth it. So, you know, order one up from, like, Pollo Real. Talk to Tom Delaney and get one of his birds. Or they do a really good... there's lots of great options out there. But just seek them out.
And so then you've got your turkey.
Right.
Tomorrow's Thanksgiving. What do we do today? What do we do tomorrow? What are some ways to think about preparing that turkey?
Okay. Well, this might come as a surprise to you, but I have some good information on cooking turkeys. Anyhow.
That's why you're here.
There's something that I've been doing for the last 3 or 4 years now, turkey-wise, at home, and I'm going to share it with our listeners today. And there's a lot of good wisdom why I do my turkeys this way. And I'm actually going to cite those reasons first, and then I'm going to tell you how I do it, all right? First of all, so much of our Thanksgiving dinners seem to come out of the oven. You've got your roasted Brussels sprouts, you might have some roasted sweet potatoes, you might have some kind of a potato gratin, the stuffing, the bird itself. So we're talking about a piece of equipment in your kitchen that's really going to be overtaxed. And unless you have, like, your order of operations and your mise en place together, it's going to be hard to get everything out of the oven. Maybe you have two ovens. Maybe.
You just said mise en place.
I said mise en place, way.
Okay.
And everything, or put in place. So that's a chefy term. Just meaning that you're organized. But unless you're very organized, you're going to run out of time or you're going to run out of oven space. And instead of that 3 o'clock dinner, you're going to be eating at 4:30 or 5. So that's one thing to contend with. Number two, when if you make gravy with your turkey, where those precious few little drops of drippings that are in the bottom of your roasting pan, you're going to use that, of course. But then you're going to also have to go out and buy like a couple boxes of chicken stock or something like that to augment your gravy. And then when it comes to carving the bird, a lot of people get really anxious about that. You know, it's difficult to do. It maybe the first cut looks all right, but then it, you know, kind of looks a bit hammered at on there on your table. So all of these things can be remedied and more with my simple turkey trick.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I am so ready.
Okay. What we're going to do now is we're going to make a turkey galantine. This is what I've been doing for the past 4 years. And it sounds high concept and it sounds difficult, but it really isn't. And
galantine?
It's very, a galantine. It's very forgiving.
That's not a guillotine.
Not a guillotine. The guillotine happened before you got the turkey.
Okay.
The turkey guillotine was
right,
down.
Anyway. Right, right.
Anyhow, the galantine is basically, this is the way that I'm doing it. So I skin the bird while it's still raw. I take the skin off it. And it's a lot easier than it sounds. I split it down the back and then just, it's like taking off pajamas. And then just take the turkey pajamas off, lay that down on your work surface. Then I cut the breast meat off of the bird, and I just kind of patchwork it together so it makes like a, you know, on top of the skin. And then I take the dark meat off the legs while it's raw.
It's all still raw.
All still raw. And I turn the dark meat into like a, kind of a chopped sausage. You know, it just like chop it up. I mix in some onions, some sage, whatever kind of flavors your family is used to experiencing. And then I roll the whole thing up. So it's got the skin on the outside, then the breast and the sausage in the middle. And I roast that. Yesterday...
Oh, my goodness.
I roasted a 14-pound bird in 40 minutes.
You just broke my brain.
The other great thing about this is I've harvested the carcass. So I've got this turkey carcass. So while I'm roasting the bird, I'm also roasting the turkey carcass. And then I have like 2 gallons of turkey stock.
You're roasting the carcass?
I put the carcass in the oven to get it nice and brown, and I make a stock out of that while I'm roasting the galantine. And so when it's time to make the gravy, I have 2 gallons-ish of delicious, delicious homemade turkey stock.
So wait a minute. You're roasting a carcass that has some but not too much meat left on it,
right.
And that becomes brown. Where's the stock? Don't you have to put it in hot water?
Yeah, exactly.
After it's
roasted?
Yeah,
you roast the carcass, and then you submerge it in water and bring it to a simmer.
Oh, okay. So yeah. Then it has that nice roasted flavor.
That's right. That's right. And it's always a good idea to cook your bones a little bit before making stock, if you want a nice clear stock. But, yeah, a nice brown roasted turkey carcass. Because actually with stock, the good stuff comes from the bones and the cartilage. It doesn't come from the flesh.
So this is a very interesting idea that I've never heard of, ladies and gentlemen. And you can try it and you can probably Google it.
That's what I would recommend. Look, go to, you know, Google or check on the interweb and just look at what a galantine is. And it... You can season everything. You can put butter inside of it. You can layer fresh herbs in
bacon.
Between the different layers. You can get your bacon working. Whatever you want, it gives you the opportunity to basically deconstruct the turkey, put it back together with all the flavors you want.
So there are some listeners who will do that.
Yes.
Most of them are still going to put the turkey covered with skin in the oven.
Correct.
And so we have to serve those listeners too.
That's right.
So what do we need to know about cooking the turkey whole in its skin in the oven?
One of the things that's difficult about cooking whole poultry is it's almost like cooking 2 different animals that are thrust together. There's the dark meat animal and the white meat animal. And they behave differently. Generally speaking, we don't like our breast meat to be overdone. We still want it to be juicy. But the dark meat benefits from a little bit of overcooking, in air quotations. So... It's difficult to pull off when you're talking about a whole bird, but it's not impossible, okay? One of the tricks is getting your bird nice and trussed, so like having the legs, the ends of the drumsticks, tie those together with a little bit of butcher's twine or something to make a more compact bird, and I will even fold the wings underneath it a little bit to just keep everything nice and compact. This will keep it moister. Some people like to start with the breast down, but I think the danger of tearing the skin off the breast when you flip it over outweighs any like benefit of keeping it moist that you might get. What else can I tell you?
How long do we cook it? Do we cook the stuffing in it?
I don't cook the stuffing in it. And for two reasons. Number one, it dramatically increases the cooking time. We're talking about adding maybe another hour, depending on the size of the bird, to get that up to temperature. And so I cook the stuffing separately. I might put like a few sprigs of parsley and a half a lemon and a piece of onion or something in the cavity, but I wouldn't stuff it with cornbread stuffing or what have you.
So you put those things in because the flavor then seeps out into the rest of the
exactly.
meat.
Exactly. Well, it's actually an aromatic perfuming, if you will, that takes place. So
yeah.
It's not so much the flavors, but the aromas of those ingredients get into the skin. So now when it comes to timing exactly, I encourage people to, well, I hate to break this to everybody, but your oven is not properly calibrated. I hate to tell you that.
Even mine?
Even yours. Just because it says 350 on the little screen or on the knob does not mean it's 350 degrees.
What does it
mean? In
the
oven. It means nothing. We have to, unless your oven has just been calibrated, and maybe yours has, Marisha.
Oh, no.
No? Unless you have a recently calibrated oven, it's probably not calibrated. So one of the things you can do is an oven thermometer. You know, to make sure that the number on the dial is the same as the temperature in the oven. But I really recommend getting an instant read thermometer, one of those thermometers that's kind of on like a long needle that you would insert into the meat and
right.
get an accurate reading of what temperature it is inside.
Yeah, those things are great.
Instant read thermometers. They make great digital ones. There's old school analog ones. And it really is a great tool. So what we're looking for with a bird, doneness of poultry is 165 degrees Fahrenheit, okay? That's totally done. There's a little something that happens, though, when we roast especially larger pieces of meat in this case, is that when we take them out of the oven, they haven't just stopped cooking magically. They're still hot, and they're going to carry over. So this element of carryover cooking will increase the internal temperature of your turkey 7.5, 8, 9 degrees. So if you want to nail that 165 degree temperature, which will be the beautifully, you know, fully done, nobody likes rosy turkey, or few people, anyway, I think it's weird,
yeah.
But we want that done, but we still want it to be nice and juicy, so 165 degrees is what we're shooting for. So I would pull my turkey at about, you know, 157, 158. And then take it out of the oven while it's sitting there, let it carry over, and it's going to come up to that 165 degrees.
Very interesting. And so if you take it out when it's 165, you run the risk of overcooking it.
Oh, well, it will, absolutely, because then it's going to carry over into the, you know, 175s, 173, whatever.
Right. And if you are cooking a turkey, what are some of the things that you put on the skin before you cook it? Okay. Do you cover it? What do you do?
Well, I'm torn when it comes to that, but definitely salt and pepper. I like to give it a nice little seeing to with some good salt and fresh ground pepper. All right.
Do you rub any oil or butter or things on it?
I'm not sure that if you do that just before it goes in the oven, if it makes much of a difference, as long as you're basting it while it's in the oven. And some people say that does dry it out, and there is reasons why that is true. But to get that beautiful, crispy, golden brown exterior that we love on turkey, you really have to baste it, and it needs some oil in there. Now, there will be, you know, juices, including fats from the turkey, that will render down into your roasting pan. So that's good stuff to baste with. But, starting off with a little olive oil or getting some butter in there, there's no shame in that.
There's no shame in butter or olive oil.
No.
Or both.
Or both, thank you. Yeah.
And a little
or
bit
bacon
of salt and pepper.
Fat.
Bacon fat is a key ingredient to almost everything.
You know, people used to, there used to be the requisite coffee can on the back of the stove where bacon drippings lived.
Yeah.
And that disappeared for about 30 years. It's coming back.
Excellent.
The coffee can full of bacon drippings is coming back. Get ahead of the curve, people.
We're talking to Rocky Durham about Thanksgiving dinner. Now, that's our turkey, and, you know, even if you do, which I always have, cooked it with the stuffing inside, and I make stuffing with kind of whatever's around, a lot of dried fruits. Sometimes if I'm going gluten-free, nice. It'll have rice or brown rice or wild rice or some combo of rice thing. And you can have apples, and I always put in whatever the nearest alcoholic beverage is, like bourbon or brandy and things like that. And they all go in, and you just kind of, it's a place to just do it by feel and do it by smell.
I applaud that.
You know what? You don't have to get up at 5 a.m. to do it. You get up at a nice, reasonable hour in the morning, and you get it all done. So it cooks an extra hour. So what? You still, if you time it right, you can still have your dinner on the table at 3.
That's right. And I like having all the people around as well. You know, some people, when they come over for dinner, maybe not our friends, but there are those guests who expect to, like, arrive and be seated. And I think it's fun to mingle and, you know, maybe if you watch football, you can sit down and, you know, catch up with your friends and family. You go for a walk while the turkey's finishing off. I mean, Thanksgiving is a great celebration of those kind of things. And that's why it's my favorite holiday.
And it's my favorite holiday, too. And I would like to say, ladies and gentlemen, I expressly forbid you to go shopping on Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
You're not allowed.
It's against the law.
It's against the law.
Yeah, they just passed that law. I don't know if you heard about it, but anyone caught shopping tomorrow is going to be arrested. That's not true, of course.
Oh, you know.
I have a friend who works at Target, and I feel so terrible for him. And he's already dreading, well, he's been dreading what they call Black Friday for about a month now.
And now there's Thursday. I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
All right. So we've talked about turkey. We've talked about what you are not allowed to do in many different ways. Let's talk about the things that go with turkey during the main meal. We'll get to dessert in a moment.
Right.
But as we've talked about in the past, when Stacey Pearl, who did this show every year up until now, she said there is no place for salad on Thanksgiving dinner. Is that true? What's your take on that?
Well, define salad. Does she mean leafy greens?
Lettuce
because
things.
The leafy green thing. Although I think we make salad on Thanksgiving, but I don't recall ever eating salad.
It just sits there.
I think it just sits there.
Yeah.
I think we feel like you should have salad. Like we're being healthy.
Just don't make salad.
Yeah.
Unless you want it. If you want to, you can do anything you want.
You know, and that's one of the things about Thanksgiving is there's so much like family tradition wrapped up in the dishes and the smells and the ritual and the plates and everything of the Thanksgiving holiday that I've got my own, and sometimes we try and impose our own ideas on others. Like, no, never Brussels sprouts. In the Durham household, always Brussels sprouts, for example. We are lovers of Brussels sprouts.
So what are some of your favorites in terms of the greens?
Right.
And we're talking pretty much cooked greens of various kinds, cooked, baked. What are some of the good Thanksgiving green vegetable things?
Well, what I like to do with my Brussels sprouts, for example, and I've done some research into why a lot of people don't like Brussels sprouts, and this is what I've come up with. Nobody cooks them enough. People want their Brussels sprouts to be bright green and perfect, like jumping off the cover of some Brussels sprout advertisement. But it seems to me that when Brussels sprouts are super bright green, they are still underdone. You really got to cook a Brussels sprout. So what I do first is blanch them in heavily salted water, and then I roast them. I get them in the oven, and I roast them till they take on lots of color. And I like to increase the surface area so there's more area for that caramelization to take place. So I cut them in half, or I cut them in quarters. And then lemon zest, chipotle, shallots, butter, salt, pepper, thyme, bacon, whatever you want. You can put on Brussels sprouts. But you gotta cook them.
And all of those flavors make them better because Brussels sprouts are one of those vegetables that really benefit from added flavors.
I think so too, yeah.
What other greens do you cook?
What other greens
or vegetables? I mean, cauliflower isn't technically green.
Cauliflowers, I lived in England for about 5 years. One of the things I took away was what they call cauliflower cheese. And cauliflower cheese is basically you blanch some cauliflower, you top it with Mornay, which is like a homemade cheese sauce, and breadcrumbs, and throw it in the oven until it's really brown. And as per is de rigueur in Britain, the vegetables are overdone, but it is delicious. So good.
And that is our one and only foray during this program into British cuisine.
They don't celebrate Thanksgiving. I wonder why.
Good point. All right, so you can make all kinds of side dishes, and there is the traditional and inevitable sweet potatoes.
Sure.
And potatoes.
Well, and actually, I have to tell another Britain story, because being the token American chef when I was living in England, that whenever Thanksgiving or 4th of July rolled around, like, the different TV shows would call me up to, like, be the token Yank, you know, so we could learn all about Thanksgiving cuisine. And I made the sweet potatoes topped with mini marshmallows for a live television broadcast. We never ate them. I know.
It's disgusting.
It sounds disgusting to me. But I thought it was such a weird American thing and something that they've never seen in England, that I prepared them on live television. And the whole time they were like, you don't really eat this in America. You're just making a joke, aren't you? And I'm like, no. People eat this.
Do they?
It really does. Well, allegedly. I mean, you've heard of that, haven't you?
Mm, no?
No. Really?
I mean,
sweet potatoes topped with mini marshmallows and then fired off in the oven?
I come from kind of immigrant roots.
Right.
You know, we make lasagna on my father's side.
There you go.
Which is still a perfect, I mean, if you come from a family where somebody doesn't like turkey and it gives them headaches, make cannelloni. I've done that in the past.
There you go.
Or make lasagna, or make some other absolutely fabulous dish that takes a while that you wouldn't do on a regular day.
Sure. That's 2 days ago, I was talking with a colleague about Thanksgiving lasagna, and I don't mean one made with turkey with some kind of a gravy sauce, but just a lasagna for Thanksgiving, and I thought, wow, that's a great idea.
Yeah, very much so. So you might make cauliflower cheese, you might make things involving marshmallows, Brussels sprouts, but let's get back to the what are some of the nice ways that don't involve marshmallows to cook sweet potatoes?
Well, I like to roast them whole. And once again, roasting, I think, like, you know, we've been talking about, the key to those flavors that we are really looking forward to on a Thanksgiving feast have to do with roasted, slow cooked, in the oven, caramelized, and sweet potatoes pick up all of those things. So, and I like to do it easy. I'll give them a little quick rinse, or maybe not if I'm feeling lazy, and I'll just cut them lengthwise, put them cut side down on like a parchment lined cookie sheet or a foil lined cookie sheet. Maybe get a little couple dabs of butter on there and a little splash of water. Put that into a 375 or 350 degree oven. But don't worry about that, because your oven's not properly calibrated. Until they take on nice color on the exterior and they're fork tender. All right. And that means you put a fork in and the fork goes in and out easily.
Right.
All right. You're not going to overcook a sweet potato until you end up burning it. So you can get them really nice and soft. Don't rush them. And you can also warm them up very easily. Now, when they come out, the jackets, the skins just come right off. You can either scoop them out with a spoon, or sometimes as you attempt to lift them from the cookie sheet, the skin will just come off, leaving the roasted, delicious, caramelized flesh behind. That's step one.
Yeah. And that's step one?
Yeah, well, then you've got, what are you going to do with them? You can like, hit them with some butter, salt, and pepper and put them in a dish and serve them. You can put sweet potatoes into a food processor and turn them into a puree. You can't do that with a regular potato because it'll make paste. But with sweet potatoes, it makes a beautiful, like, mashed sweet potatoes. That's one way to proceed. I think that ginger and garlic go nice with sweet potatoes.
Really?
And even ginger, garlic, and a little red chili, something slightly spicy, works well with that sweet and caramelized.
What about regular potatoes?
Regular potatoes.
Do you mash them?
I do mash them, absolutely. And when it comes to regular potatoes, first of all, that's another opportunity where, like, if you're trying to spend your organic produce budget wisely, root veg are a really good place to exercise that. So,
because they absorb
potato.
All the
nasty
they live
in the dirt.
Stuff in the, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, if there's all the fertilizer and pesticides and whatever, then guess what? Anyhow, so peel your potatoes. You don't have to get pedantic. If there's a couple little, you know, bits of peel left behind, that's fine. But then I cut them into quarters, all right, lengthwise and then in half. So it makes four equal size pieces, but also of the similar shape, all right? If you slice your potato and then simmer it, too much starch is going to be extracted.
Ah.
So you really want to be careful about that, because what we love about mashed potatoes is that like the holy matrimony of starch and fat, and the fat's probably going to be cream or milk and butter. And but if you can get those things just like right on. So anyway, we want the starch there. Don't slice them into little coins to try and accelerate the cooking process, or cut them up too small, because you'll notice when you look down into that pot, there's that kind of yellowish milky quality to the simmering liquid, and that's all your starch coming out of suspension. So you want that in the potato.
Now, could you have your holy matrimony grease be bacon grease?
Yeah, why not? Absolutely.
Because bacon and potatoes, I mean,
I've heard of that. Exactly. Bacon and potatoes love each other. I wouldn't use all bacon, like, drippings for that, but because there is something about that creamy richness of butter. And I would get some whole butter in there as well. And that's when you look at butters, there's some butters that are less expensive and some that are more expensive. And the reason why is the percentage of fat. Like, if they have very low fat percentage, those are going to be cheap butters.
And interesting.
And then there's all sorts of other stuff in there, like water, that you're paying for.
Right.
And those more expensive butters are going to be more fat, which is what you're looking for.
So we have our turkey, we have our vegetables, we have our potatoes and our sweet potatoes. We're pretty full now, but we're going to take a deep breath and start toward dessert.
All right, dessert. You ready?
Yes.
What's the most popular dessert in the Mary Charlotte household?
Let's say it together.
Okay,
apple pie.
Yeah, you got to have apple pie.
And I've now given away my secret. I give it away every year, so it really can no longer be called a secret. But while I am making before I make the pie crust, I peel the apples, cut them up, and let them rest while I'm making the pie crust in a bowl full of rum and brandy.
Come on.
Turning them every once in a while.
There's no shame in that.
Oh, no, it makes it really, really good. And nobody can tell once you serve the pie, nobody can tell that it has rum and brandy in it. They say, gosh, this is good pie.
Right. And I would like to point out, like, to the listeners as well, one of the reasons why you wouldn't be able to detect that as much is the alcohol burns off.
Right.
You know, so you're just left with the, you know, some of those residual aromatics that are left behind. But without that alcohol hotness, a lot of people don't recognize rum and brandy.
And that makes a good apple pie. And you don't have to cover the pie crust. You can make a crumble crust with
a little streusel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are delicious. And I think that's a great kind of entry-level top crust for the amateur pie maker, because they're really forgiving. You're not going to like overwork it. It's not going to be tough. It's just going to be buttery and delicious. All you have to do is get it brown.
So that's entry level.
Yeah.
Let's talk about advanced. What do you do with your apple pie?
You know what? I remember a cover of Gourmet magazine from like 20 years ago, that probably from November, and it had a shot of apple pie, and they had done this collaged top crust they had cookie cutters of different autumn leaves, and they cut all these different autumn leaves, and then so the appearance of this finished pie was like a pile of dried autumn leaves. They had like maple leaves and different shaped leaves. It was really kind of beautiful.
That's the aesthetic part of it.
That's the aesthetic part. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can try like the lattice top, and when you look at the whole pie, it does look very impressive. One of these like collage tops or lattice work top. But I'll tell you what, when you cut into the pie and you're looking at one little piece, somebody's going to say, "Where's the rest of my top crust?" So I think if you are going to do a top crust, a streusel topping, or just one complete sheet of like an entire top crust, one intact top crust.
And what kind of apples do you use? As we've talked about many times, the apples have a harder time cooking at this altitude than at sea level.
Well, one of the things about, anything that's got water cooks at a lower temperature here. Well, just because water volatilizes at a lower temperature.
The boiling point is lower here.
Exactly, thanks to air pressure or lack thereof. I like to use a mixture of apples, though, because there is something to be said for the humble Granny Smith. They've got that real tart, tartaric acid, real like side of the tongue tartness, and great crispness to them. And I think if you are going to like mix up your apples, we do want to lean towards the crisp side and less of the mealy side of apples, because sometimes those mealy apples we don't appreciate as much, especially when they're cooked.
So how do you get them to... Yeah, no, I mean, mealy apples are gross under all circumstances, whether you're eating an apple or cooking it. But do you steam them for a minute before you put them in? I mean, what do you do to make sure they cook?
Well, I actually I do a cooked fruit method. So I'll peel the apples and I cut them into the right size portion for, you know, when I think of apple pie, I want to see like kind of slices of like almost wedges of apple in there, not like a dice or something like that.
Right.
And then I will mix it with a little bit of butter, maybe a little lemon juice, some aromatics that, you know, people, my family, my gorgeous wife might be expecting, a little nutmeg, a little cinnamon, maybe a little ground ginger in there as well. And then I put it on the stovetop and I just bring it, you know, get it hot and let it simmer in that butter and some of the natural juices come out before. And then I'm going to cool that down and then assemble my pie.
It is time to go, ladies and gentlemen. There's much more we could talk about, but we would like to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving and thank Rocky Durham for being with us. He is executive chef and co-founder of the Santa Fe Culinary Academy. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio
Cafe. Thanks so much, Mary Charlotte. Happy Thanksgiving.